That is what has been attacked in these past 30 years. What was failing and collapsing when history was declared over was something very specific in 1989, when Francis Fukuyama made that famous declaration, and when the Washington Consensus was declared also in 1989. What was collapsing was centralized state communism, authoritarian, anti-democratic, repressive. Something very specific was collapsing. And it was a moment of tremendous flux, and it was in that moment of flux and disorientation that several very savvy people, many of them in this country, seized on that moment to declare victory not only against communism, but against all ideas but their own. Now, this was the Fukuyama chutzpah, when he actually said, and it seems so strange to read it now in his famous 1989 speech, that the significance of that moment was not that we were reaching an end of ideology, as some were suggesting, or a convergence between capitalism and socialism, as Gorbachev was suggesting. It was that ideology had ended, but that history as such had ended. He argued that deregulated markets in the economic sphere, combined with liberal democracy in the political sphere, represented the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the final form of human government. Now, what was interesting and never quite stated in this formulation was that you basically had two streams. You had democracy, which you could use to vote for your leaders, and then you had a single economic model. Now, the catch was that you couldn't use your vote, you couldn't use your democracy to reshape your economy because all of the economic decisions had already been decided. It was the final endpoint of ideological evolution. So you could have democracy, but you couldn't use it to change the basics of life. You couldn't use it to change the economy. This moment was held up as a celebration of victory for democracy, but that idea that democracy cannot affect the economy is and remains the single most anti-democratic idea of our time. Now, I was drawn to the slogan that was chosen for this year's ASA gathering, because I think, as many of you know and have read in the program, it comes from the World Social Forum. And I was at the first World Social Forum more than six and a half years ago, in January 2001 in Porto Alegre, Brazil. I was one of only a handful of North Americans who attended. And we gathered under that same slogan. But I think it's significant and interesting that it wasn't posed as a question back then. There was a proud exclamation mark at the end of the sentence. Another world is possible. I wrote a feature article for The Nation when I came back from Brazil, trying to explain to readers in the U.S. The event wasn't covered at all, although it was covered very heavily in the international press, what it felt like to be there with 10,000 other people. And a lot of people were saying that they felt like we were making history. And what I wrote was that what it really felt like was the end of the end of history. That's what it felt like to be in that room. It was this powerful gust of wind that you could suddenly breathe more deeply. You were free to imagine. Our minds were unleashed. And it wasn't just Porto Alegre, because Porto Alegre was the culmination of these types of spontaneous uprisings that were happening around the world whenever world leaders were gathering to advance the so-called Washington Consensus, whether it was in Seattle at the WTO meeting in 1999, whether it was the IMF World Bank meetings a few years later in Washington, then in Genoa during the G8, and of course the Zapatistas and the MST in Brazil were at the forefront. And the theme in Porto Alegre was democracy. It was about redefining democracy to include the economy, deep democracy, participatory democracy. And it was a challenge to this idea that these two streams could not intersect. The right to land as a form of democracy, the right to biodiversity, to independent media. But what was most extraordinary about Porto Alegre was that, you know, certainly there were some politicians there, there were some big NGOs there, but the people who were on the, at the podiums, who were shaping the discussion, were the people who were the casualties of this economic model, who were themselves discarded, made landless, forced to occupy pieces of land, chop down fences, and plant food, and make decisions democratically. So, you know, Jeffrey Sachs talks about these model villages that he's building in Africa, and many of them are, you know, are making tremendous progress. But I can't help thinking back to these field trips that we made in Porto Alegre to MST villages, where it was the people themselves, the landless people themselves, who were showing us their own model villages and were asking for our solidarity. And I think as sociologists, you understand this key distinction, that it was the actors, it was who were the protagonists of their history. And that was what was historic. It was breaking the charity model in a very real way. Now, I look at where we are now, 6.5 years later, and it does feel that we have moved backwards in many areas. Talk of fixing the world has become an astonishingly elite affair. Davos, and now the Porto Alegre was a rebellion against the Davos summit every year in January. This was the anti-Davos. Davos has been re-legitimized. And now solving the world's problems appears to be a matter between CEOs and super celebrities. And the idea that we don't need to challenge these mass disparities, what we need is sort of noblesse oblige on a mass scale. That is very different than what we were talking about in Porto Alegre those years ago. Now, we know what closed that window of possibility, that freedom that opened up in 2001, and it was September 11th in this country, and the window didn't close everywhere, but it did close, at least temporarily, in North America, that sense of possibility that putting these issues and the people affected by these policies at the center of the political debate. Now, the shock of those attacks, I think we can see with some hindsight, was harnessed by leaders in this country and their allies around the world to abruptly end the discussion of global justice that was exploding around the world. There was a door that had opened, and it was suddenly slammed shut. We heard that phrase again and again, 9/11 changes everything. And one of the first things we were told that it had changed was that trade, privatization, labor rights, all the things we were fighting for just so recently, no longer mattered. It was year zero, wipe the slate clean. And it was another one of these rebooting history moments. History was apparently starting all over again from scratch, and nothing we knew before mattered. It was all relegated to pre-9/11 thinking. Now, the Bush administration justified this by saying that all that mattered was security and the war on terror. And in Canada, we were told that by the U.S. ambassador that security trumps trade. That became the new slogan. That before 9/11, it was economic priorities that drove the U.S. administration. But post 9/11, the only thing that mattered was security. So talk of economic justice, corporate greed, the loss of the public sphere, the talk of Porto Alegre was suddenly retro. So 2001. Now the irony that we can now see is that while denying the importance of this economic project, the Bush administration used the dislocation of 9/11 to pursue the very same pre-9/11 radical capitalist project, now with a furious vengeance under the cover of war and natural disasters. So forget negotiating trade deals at the World Trade Organization. When the US invaded Iraq, Bush sent in Paul Bremer to seize new markets on the battlefields of his preemptive war. He didn't have to negotiate with anyone. He just rewrote the country's entire economic architecture in one swoop. But of course, if